Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. Today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. He comes on our program every other week as one of our regular guests, and we greatly appreciate his presence here on this program to give a left perspective of U.S. politics and where the right is going wrong and where the left, what we should be expecting on the left to bring about a positive change here in this country and also the world. And Alan, once again, I'd like to welcome you to the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart. I look forward to this.
Alan, today what we're going to be discussing is a left agenda for 2014. And also what we're going to start the program, how we're going to start the program today is providing a left perspective on Obama's State of the Union. We know just last week Obama, he came out with his dazzling oratory for the State of the Union. So many people are always impressed with what he has to say. But we look at the substance of what he is saying. And when you look at the substance, Alan, you really don't see any changes. You don't see any promises that he has made in the past that we can see that there's an agenda to help the nation move forward, especially an agenda for working people. So, first of all, Alan, I would just like you to give a brief comment in regards to the recent State of the Union that the president, that he made. And then we're going to get into some of the comments that you made, because you were posting almost moment by moment in regards to some of the comments, some of the things that were coming out of his speech. But what were your thoughts and your ideas about the State of the Union, Alan?
Well, overall, I think it was a terrible speech from working people's perspective. He uses all these sound bites, and he appealed to each and every segment of the people that were supporting him, claiming to be progressives and liberals and even leftists. And the thing is, he provided these sound bites, but he didn't, like you said, he didn't provide any substance to back up anything. This was supposed to be a speech about economic inequality. You know, he hit on that message and noted that there was economic inequality in the country, but what is he going to do to overcome that? What is he going to do to fight poverty? Nothing. You know, he didn't provide one single
right.
thing that he was going to do or that the government could do to put an end to poverty. And, you know, this poverty situation in our country and around the world is just terrible, and it's getting worse. First you had health care bills driving people into poverty. Now we got heating bills driving people into poverty. You know, where does this all end? You know, we're on the road to hell in this country, and Obama is leading us there.
Exactly. I look at some of the statements that you made, and they ring very true. It says, those who hoped Obama and the Democrats would do the right things have now transgressed to hoping he would say the right things, and Obama even refused to fulfill his dreams in the State of the Union, in his State of the Union speech. But, you know, people, even though he's been promising year after year in these State of the Union addresses, we almost have come to expect that, you know, it's going to be a good speech, but we're not going to get anything past this speech. But what you're saying, they were hoping, now they're just hoping that, that he'll just say the right things.
Exactly. And if you notice, all these organizations, the Sierra Club, the AFL-CIO, the NAACP, they all took his words, and they made, like, billboards out of his words and put them on the Internet as if we were supposed to be satisfied that he uttered these words, which didn't have any substance behind them nor any plan of action. And I purposely placed Lyndon Johnson's speech on my Facebook page that he made where he, his speech about the war on poverty. And not that I'm a fan of Lyndon Johnson or anything, but at least he was a president. He outlined the problems after talking to people like Martin Luther King and other civil rights activists. He talked to them about the problems that people were having, and he worked with them to create programs that were solutions to those problems, and he actually did what he said he was going to do. It was limited, but at least he did what he said he was going to do. He did things that were very substantial. Obama is doing absolutely nothing to resolve any problems that working people or any other people are having. The only people that he's helping are the very wealthiest people in this country, the Wall Street crowd. Nobody else gets any help at all from Obama or the Democrats, and for sure not the Republicans. You know, it's time for a new political party, and Obama's speech should tell us that.
You say the Democrats and Republicans talk about the Bible. Apparently, they don't understand the basis premises, seeking the truth.
I'm not a religious person or anything, but I'm not a religious person or anything. But I do understand the basic premise of the Bible. If the Bible has any premise at all, it is that we always should be seeking the truth. And this group of people that's in power right now, all they do is lie. They lie about everything. If they utter a word, if they hold a press conference, you know you're going to get a lie out of them. And it's the same thing with. You know, we're having a big problem up here in Minnesota with this whole propane issue and heating our homes. People now have thousands of dollars a month in home heating bills. They don't know how they're going to pay these
bills. The bills have tripled.
And they're getting no help at all from the government. The government is actually subsidizing the people, the monopolies that have created this problem. They're giving these monopolies low-interest loans to secure propane to sell to us at very high interest rates. You know, my propane company is charging me 18% interest a year on the part of the bill that I can't pay. Right now I owe around $3,000. I know people that owe, and that's just for this winter. I know people that still owe from last winter that have bills now this winter of $7,000 and $9,000, people that live right around me. These are just people in small homes, homes that are maybe 700 to 900 square feet. These are enormous heating bills. And these monopolies are just ripping us off and robbing us left and right. And the government isn't stepping in to do anything except to help them rip us off even more. You know, this is the direction the country is headed.
And, I'm just looking at some of the things. You said Obama handed the poor a ladder out of poverty. The problem, the ladder has two prongs.
Two rungs.
Could you explain what you were saying there?
Sure.
You say the bottom prong is one to poverty. Let me see.
Here's how it works. Obama has developed this concept. Actually, he stole it from the Republicans. The Republicans started talking about handing people a ladder out of poverty, and their concept of a ladder out of poverty is setting up these savings accounts for poor people. Poor people are supposedly supposed to save their money, and after they save their money, they'll be able to buy the things that they need. I mean, this is just insanity taken to the nth degree. And now Obama has taken that concept of a ladder out of poverty. What he's saying is that I'm going to hand you you're down in a hole, and you're stuck down there, and I'm going to hand you a ladder to help you up out of the hole. The problem is there's only two rungs on the ladder. One rung is right on the bottom, and the other rung is right on the top. There's no way for people to climb this ladder out of poverty. The needed program to get people out of poverty.
You're either at the top or you're at the bottom.
They're not there. There's only one way to get people out of poverty, and that's to give them a job that pays real living wages, or to guarantee them a basic, give them a basic income guarantee. And if the government isn't going to pay have a minimum wage that pays a real living non-poverty wage, can you imagine the same government giving people a basic income guarantee like Thomas Paine advocated? I don't see that happening unless there's a massive struggle on the part of the people to demand it. And that's what it's going to take, not these phony schemes where Obama's saying, I'm going to hand you a ladder out of poverty, because there are no rungs on this ladder for people to climb the ladder.
Right, exactly. It's always going to be that disparity. You say if we can't eliminate poverty in the richest country in the world, how can we ever expect poverty to be eradicated any place else in the world? Obviously, these questions are too complex for these Wall Street bribe politicians to solve. Why? Very simply, poverty wages means super profits for Wall Street.
Right. And what we see developing...
But can you explain how poverty wages... Explain to our listeners how poverty wages relate to the extreme profits that we see for the super rich, Alan.
Well, the way that it relates is that the lower the wages are, the more profits for the big corporations. If a McDonald's can pay somebody a minimum wage instead of paying them a real living wage of $15 or $20 an hour, which they could do, only the profits would suffer. It wouldn't shove them into bankruptcy or anything else. Only the profits would suffer a little bit, and the shareholders wouldn't get quite so much. They could be paying people these real living wages, but they don't, because all that they do not pay in wages is profit to them, sheer profit. They're skimming the cream right off the top of what labor produces. And this is the problem that creates inequality in our country. And it's going to keep creating poverty. Instead of giving people a ladder out of poverty by giving them a real living minimum wage, by keeping a minimum wage that is a poverty wage, that keeps people in poverty. You know, this is common sense. I just got a postcard in the mail today from these Democratic Party front groups who are trying to rally people to support a $9.50 minimum wage as if it's something progressive. This is not progressive. These Democrats, including Obama, ran a campaign promising living non-poverty wages. The Democratic Party platform calls for people who work full-time to have real living wages that aren't poverty wages. Yet, when it comes to legislation, what do we get from them? More poverty wages. And the governor of Minnesota, a Democrat with a Democratic supermajority, said that he was for a $9.50 minimum wage, and yet last week he met in secret with the heads of the Chamber of Commerce here in Minnesota, and they agreed that the legislation would go ahead to raise the minimum wage, and the minimum wage would be just under $8 an hour. And it's $6.15 an hour right now, the state minimum wage. You know, this is the kind of betrayal, it's the worst kind of betrayal imaginable. And these labor leaders that have supported concession contract after concession contract, are now trying to shove another poverty wage down the throats of the people that are rising up and demanding real living wages. We should not allow these people to co-opt our movements like they did in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Michigan. We should keep these movements grassroots and rank-and-file movements with the people who are suffering coming forward as the leaders demanding real living wages. You know, we've written an open letter to Governor Dayton and the Democrats here in Minnesota, and we told them, you're trying to pull a bait and switch on us. You campaigned on the premise of living wages. That's all you talked about. Now when it comes to the time to legislating a minimum wage, you come with another poverty wage. This is bait and switch. You know, in the retail industry, this is what they call it, bait and switch, and it's illegal. It
right.
should be illegal in politics. The only way to make it illegal is by not voting for these people.
Here you're mentioning in Obama's recent State of the Union last week, Obama calls a $10 an hour job eliminating poverty. Obviously, Obama doesn't have to go to the grocery store shopping, pay mortgage or rent, fill up his gas tank or pay home heating bills, let alone pay for health insurance or college tuition. What planet is Obama living on? But when you think about a $10 per hour wage to eliminate poverty, Alan, it is completely pathetic, because what is $10 an hour? What are you going to get for that? You're going to get approximately $1,700 a month. That's going to be your income. Out of $1,700 a month, Alan, basically, when you look at, let's look at the most inexpensive apartment that you can get here in California. Well, I won't even go into Los Angeles, but let's look at Riverside or San Bernardino County. where you get your most inexpensive apartment, one bedroom for around $650. Right away, just looking at your gross income, one-third of your income is already gone. And here this president is calling for poverty, a minimum wage, which is only going to guarantee more poverty. What is that all about, Alan?
Well, you know, anybody with an ounce of common sense understands that anybody that has to buy groceries, pay a mortgage or a rent, fill up the car with gas, or even buy, you know, pay for bus every day, you know, working people, they aren't going to be able to afford anything that amounts to a decent standard of living on $10 an hour. I mean, this is such basic common sense. It's unbelievable that the President of the United States would even advocate a $10 an hour minimum wage. And he knows that, you know, he's not going to get a $10 minimum wage out of the Congress. And he's not attempting to mobilize the American people behind that. I mean, if the American people were actually mobilized for a real living wage, we would see millions and millions of people out in the streets of this country, just like we've in the past we've seen millions of people out in the streets for peace. But on this kitchen table issue of a living wage, Obama is so out of it, it's not even funny. And it's not a problem with just him not understanding the issue, which I think is part of the problem because he has so much money. You know, when a person has so much money that the prices of things in the store mean nothing to them, you know, this is how are these people going to be expected to legislate on behalf of working people a living wage? You know, it's ridiculous to even consider that these people have any kind of concept of what a living wage is. The government's own figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is a division of the U.S. Department of Labor, they have a whole chart that explains the price increases and in the prices of goods and services in this country. They have 8 categories and 200 subcategories. You know, if you don't want to go through a grocery store, just look at those charts, and you will see there's no way that a $10 an hour wage can be a non-poverty wage. This is the epitome of just the worst kind of arrogance on the part of the rich and the wealthy who create poor people, and then they don't want to look at them and they don't want to hear about their problems. You know, this is what we're dealing
right
with in this country.
You say, let's discuss this $10 an hour Obama is going to be paying workers employed by private contractors bidding on government work. First of all, $10 is not a living wage by any far-fetch of the imagination. Second, these workers are being employed for the purpose of privatizing work that should be done by public employees. Now, that's very important because he's talking about just for these contractors, but what you're saying, Alan, is this work that Obama is talking about, these should be paying for jobs for public workers.
These jobs should be paying, people in these jobs should be getting $30 to $35 an hour. This is what they should be getting.
Right.
And for Obama, this is the worst kind of union busting, and that's exactly what it is. Because
it's union busting.
Yeah, people don't understand this. When Obama talks about these low-wage contract workers, he's not telling the truth. The government is paying these big agencies to hire people to do the jobs that government needs to be done. And these people that are employing these people are getting enormous profits that they're not paying to the workers. What they're paying in profits to these companies that are hiring these workers could be going to wages by the government directly hiring these people, these workers. This is how it should be done. And the government, Obama included, along with all the Democrats and Republicans, they're trying to destroy all of our social programs. If you look at Social Security, these contract workers are, a lot of the people are custodians and stuff in these big government buildings where you have people working for the Social Security Administration, where they're working for Medicaid and Medicare. And, you know, this kind of work, it's a form of very modern slavery is what it amounts to. These workers
right
could be employed by the government just like the people sitting behind the desks doing the work for Social Security. and they're eliminating a lot of the jobs that have been union jobs, too. I lived in the state of Virginia where the government hires thousands of these contractors. The government doesn't hire the contractors. The government takes bids from companies who then hire these contract workers. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a government that's out to bust the public service unions. That's all that it amounts to. Why are these public service unions, like AFSCME and the public service unions, the National Public Service Unions, keep supporting Obama? It's just unbelievable. They're slitting their own throats.
And as you mentioned, and which you already know exactly what you put out there in regards to your statements, but you had mentioned fourth, and this is a real irony besides the situation. The situation is a modern-day form of slavery. These workers are being employed as scabs to bus the public workers' unions as millions, as millionaire leaders and their unions cheer Obama on. Alan, what's going on with these unions? Because, I mean, have they just forsaken the working class?
Well, for sure. Every single member of the, including Richard Trumka and the rest of the AFL-CIO Executive Council, these are all millionaires. They've used our unions to take dues from working people, and they've used those dues to enrich themselves and to become millionaires. This is why they don't want to challenge the system as it exists. You'll never hear any of these people talking about changing, you know, to a new kind of system of socialism. All that you'll hear from these people is about regulations and so-called reforms of the financial system. You know, it's impossible to reform the financial system of the present capitalist system, the state monopoly capitalist system, which is an enormous system of empire and imperialism right now. This is not a system that can be reformed, and people have to understand the difference between reforming the system and winning reforms that actually help working people and all people. There is a difference. We fight for reforms to for health care, for better education, to create jobs. These are the kind of reforms that can be won, but they'll be won on the road to socialism. They will not be won on the road to reforming or regulating capitalism to become some kind of better system. The capitalist system is shot. It's crumbling before our very eyes. None of these labor leaders realize this. If they do understand this, they're not saying it because they know that they will no longer be getting these hundreds of thousands of dollar salary jobs that they have now. You know, Richard Trumka gets around $200,000 a year, I think. Many of these other labor leaders, they get $180,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year. They sit on various pension boards and health and welfare funds where they get another $100,000 or $200,000 a year. You know, obviously these people are millionaires if they're making this kind of money year after year. And, you know, how can they possibly represent working people? They have no sense of the urgency of the problems that working people are facing. No, they can't relate at all. Even if they mean well, they can't relate. It's not an urgent situation to them that people sitting up here in northern Minnesota have no way of paying their heating bills. This is not an urgent situation to them. They're not sitting under blankets trying to keep warm in a non-heated house. You know, they are not worried about losing their homes because they can't afford their mortgage. They are not worried about the price of milk when they go to the grocery store or the price of hamburger. They're not concerned that the price of hamburger has gone from, you know, you could buy a tube of this 5-pound cheap hamburger a year ago for $8. Now that same 5-pound tube of hamburger, cheap hamburger, nothing but fat, is costing us, you know, $18 or $20. They're not concerned about any of this because they can go and buy steak. It means nothing to them to go into a butcher shop and buy the highest quality steaks that cost, you know, $16, $17, $18 a pound. This is what they, this is their lifestyle. They'll go
That's
buy
the way
lobster.
They live. That's the way
That's
they roll.
Exactly. So they have no sense of urgency at all about solving the problems of the people. So the sound bites that they're getting from Obama, it sounds nice to them, and they put it on these billboards plastering the internet day in and day out ever since Obama made his speech. And it's pathetic because there's not – and, you know, I'm not minimizing this or anything, but there is not one single solution Obama brought forward, not one. You know, and this is an insult to the intelligence of the American people, and the American people are beginning to understand this. You know, some people don't yet, but I was sent a comment that Malcolm X made, and Malcolm X said, don't be in such a hurry to condemn a person because he doesn't do what you do or think as you think. There was a time when you didn't know what you know today. But this is not the situation with these labor leaders. They know the situation today. They know the problems, and but they also know that they're not going to be up on the top if they start taking on and challenging this rotten capital system or even advocating for real reforms. And, you know, they're not even trying to hold Obama accountable. Richard Trumka and Leo Gerard, they talked about, oh, we'll hold his feet to the fire once he gets elected. I don't think anybody has seen them even strike a match yet to create the heat or, you know, light the fire to start with.
Alan, I'm just going to make a quick break here. I just want to mention that we have Alan Mack. He's joining the Socialist Insight this evening. He comes on our program every other week. He shares a lot of good information that the left can be able to food for thought. And, Alan, once again, I'd like to thank you for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
And as I mentioned, Alan, today what we're discussing is two things, a left agenda for 2014. We're going to start talking about that in around 15 minutes or so, and also to give a left perspective on Obama's State of the Union. And when I say State of the Union, I didn't say State of the Union address, because we know that is it's a speech, you know, just to sound good. But we want to really talk about Obama's State of the Union. And, Alan, I just want to get a little bit – I read information from time to time from Stephen Lindman. He writes a lot of columns, goes on the Internet. Also, I wanted to just make a very brief statement in regards to what you had mentioned a few seconds ago in regards to the $10 an hour, the minimum wage that everyone is talking about. And it's being talked about not because of labor leaders, and I believe you mentioned this also, Alan, is not being talked about because of labor leaders. It's because the public, they're talking about it. You see it all over the Internet. People are calling for $10 an hour, and now we see the many of the politicians, we see the labor leaders getting on the bandwagon because they think that this is popular thought. But, you know, people need to understand that even $10 an hour is still poverty wages. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that as well, Alan. But back to what I was saying about Stephen Lindman, he writes many articles. And in addition to that, he had written this article, Obama's Abominable State of the Union. And the State of the Union, ever since Obama took office, has just been crumbling. I mean, it's far worse than what it was before he took office. But one of the things I noticed in this article that was written, it says in his first State of the Union address, he promised to get our economy growing again, save as many jobs as possible, and help Americans who'd become unemployed. But Alan, we haven't seen this happening, because when you look at, also mentioned in the same article, it says real unemployment exceeds 23%. Long-term unemployment is at record levels. And when you look at the real numbers, Alan, it's they're talking about these low numbers of 7 or 8 million people that are unemployed. Alan, we have like tens of millions of people. The numbers are really close to like 90 million plus people that are unemployed, people that could work, that could have good paying jobs. I'm not talking about these part-time jobs working at McDonald's and working at small shops or anything like that, or grocery clerks, you know, where you're pushing, clearing a lot of baskets. But I'm talking about good paying jobs working in industry and manufacturing, jobs that are paying $30 an hour and more. Those jobs are not out there, Alan. And here we look at a president that was talking about 5 years ago, creating good-paying jobs and creating a way for people to come out of poverty, the president hasn't done anything to fulfill any of these promises. What are your comments on that?
Okay, well, I think there's a lot of confusion about what a good job is, first of all. A good job is any job that needs to be done, provided it pays a real living wage, has decent benefits, and is a decent place to work with that protects the health and well-being of the person doing that job. So, you know, for some reason, these people keep talking about creating good jobs. Well, what we got to be asking, why isn't every job in this country a good job? This is the question we got to be asking. And the reason that these jobs aren't good jobs is because the employers fight tooth and nail to keep these jobs, poverty wage jobs. They fight tooth and nail to prevent decent benefits from being provided to working people. They fight tooth and nail to create the kind of healthy and safe atmosphere for workers to work in. This is why these jobs are not good jobs. No matter what jobs these people create, they're not going to be good jobs. They're going to be poverty wage jobs. And let me tell you, Stuart, and everybody listening, you know, the Democrats here in Minnesota, they've had the largest job-creating program in the history of the state of Minnesota in the Indian gaming industry when they created these compacts that created the Indian gaming industry. They shoved and pushed and forced 44,000 Minnesotans into these jobs. These jobs are in smoke-filled casinos. They're in loud, noisy, smoke-filled casinos. And each and every one of these casino workers is paid a poverty wage that they can't even live on, no matter how many hours a week they work. They have no rights under these compacts that were created by these Democrats. They have no rights under state or federal labor laws or any other labor laws. You know, these are the kind of jobs that have been created. And across this country are now almost 2 million people working in more than 350 of these Indian gaming and casino operations. And these are jobs that the Democrats had been boasting of creating until we started talking about the conditions of employment that these people are being forced to work in and under. You know, and it's no different with McDonald's or Menards in here in Minnesota. They put up a huge Menards store on the Iron Ridge, bigger than most of the Menards, because they want to use it to stockpile their lumber and everything else out of Canada coming into the States. And it's a huge operation. And they're paying people $8.50 an hour. $8.50 an hour.
$8.50
And John Menard is a multi-billionaire many times over. And many of these people are only working 12 and 14 hours a week. Some of them get their get maybe 24, 25, 26 hours a week. They're those so-called lucky ones. But all part-time employees, because Menards doesn't want to have to pay any benefits. These are the kind of jobs we're talking about. Why a job working in a casino or a job working at Menards or a job working at McDonald's or Burger King or any place else shouldn't be a good job? This is something Obama and these Democrats are going to have to explain when they start going out campaigning, that they're going to create jobs, jobs, jobs. And then they say every 2 years they're saying, oh, yeah, we want to create good jobs. But the jobs that are being created are poverty wage jobs, and it's being done intentionally and by intent by this government. When this government legislates a poverty minimum wage, that is a wage that's being forced upon the American people through legislation and by the government. This is not just corporations enforcing a poverty wage. This is government using the levers of government to force people into poverty, and we shouldn't make any mistake about this. I'm getting so sick of hearing these politicians talking about these so-called living wages, and then they go around and they turn around and they legislate another poverty wage. This is a terrible situation, and this is why people are so pissed off in this country. The people that have said they have no faith in government, they're the same people that are out in the streets and out demanding a real living wage. And this is the kind of movement we, as a left, should be organizing. It's not enough that people are just angry and fed up. We should be organizing massive organizations, united organizations of the people, with grassroots and rank-and-file activists leading these organizations, not a bunch of millionaire labor leaders who hold a press conference and say they're going to do something, and then they do nothing after they hold their press conference. And this is what's been going on in this country, and we've got to organize. We've got to get people out in the streets to demand what we want out of government. this is the way the working people in this country got the WPA and the CCC programs and the CETA program. We would, the people would have gotten nothing. They would have remained mired in unemployment unless they got out in the streets and demanded these things. Even a liberal guy, a nice progressive-thinking guy like Franklin Roosevelt, would not have delivered the kinds of programs that were needed to put people back to work in the millions if people had not been out in the streets. And this is what people have to learn. People haven't had these experiences of organizing these massive demonstrations and creating large organizations, not since the 60s and 70s in this country. And this is something that we got to revive and get back to doing. And we can't rely on these so-called leaders to do this.
And what you're saying also, I look at the industry that I work in. I work in the automobile industry, and you have porters, the ones that are responsible for making certain that cars are prepped to get them ready to deliver and things of that nature. But many of them, instead of hiring one person for 40 hours at $8.50 an hour, what they'll do is they'll have two people working for 20 hours each, or they make certain that they don't have full-time employment. And some of these people have to feed and take care of their families, and subsequently they're competing with other young people that are making the same $8.50 an hour. And subsequently, these people, some are just making enough income so that they can be able to live at home with their mom and their dad and have some spending money. And other ones have some serious needs where they got to take care of their families. But Alan, this is another problem. What we have is where they make certain that these people can't have full-time employment where they can qualify for benefits, and it's happening across the nation.
Oh, all across the country, in every single industry. And, you know, this is something that's got to be fought, and it's got to be done in an organized way. People are going to have to get together. You know, the left should have convened a conference many months ago, if not several years ago, about this issue of the minimum wage. And we should have come to some kind of consensus on what kind of struggle we wanted to launch. I have a lot of respect for this 15 or fight movement on the minimum wage. But what is still missing from this movement and what's not being talked about in this country is that the only relationship that we should be talking about as working people is the relationship between wages and cost of living. Nothing means anything else until you start to examine what we can buy with wages. And employers just hate to hear that. I was in a bargaining session way back in the 1970s from the Building Trades Council when I was working as a carpenter. And when I was in the bargaining session, I said, you know, let's talk about our cost of living. You know, you want to talk about wages as if they don't relate to anything. Let's talk about what wages relate to. And this John Boom, who was from the roofers, he had a big roofing company, he stood up and pointed his finger at me and turned all red, and he says, I knew you were a effing communist. He says, nobody talks like this except for a communist. You know, and they did not want to, these employers did not want to hear about relating wages to cost of living. And if you think about it and if you read history and look at history, if you go back and look at the old leaflets from those that built the CIO unions, the old industrial unions, and with the UAW, the steel workers, all these leaflets talked about, you know, how much can you buy with your wages? How much is a loaf of bread? How much is milk? You know, how much is a hamburger? And they constantly made this relation between wages and what people could buy. And we haven't been doing that in this country. And that's one of the reasons why we've got all these concession union contracts. And now these very labor leaders who have shoved these concession union contracts down their own members' throats, they haven't been able to improve the lives and livelihoods of their own members. They now somehow come to the forefront of the struggle over the minimum wage. You know, why? Nobody invited them into the struggle except for the Democrats and Obama. Yeah, working people didn't ask them. They didn't say to Richard Trumka, hey, help us out. You know, he was never asked. And so what
personally,
we
I don't
do
think
is,
they're invited.
No, they're not.
I don't
but
think
they,
they're invited. They shouldn't be invited.
In order to break a movement.
Exactly. What they're trying to do is just co-opt a movement. That's all it is.
Exactly.
The movement is moving without the unions, Alan.
a vice president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, a guy named Mark Fromke, actually told me a couple weeks ago, he said, we will never fight for a minimum wage above $9.50. And he told me the reason was is because we're not going to fight for more because we're not getting union dues out of these people. You know, this is pathetic. This is a pathetic way for a labor leader to look at this entire situation of people living in poverty, to say that they're not going to do anything for working people because they're not getting union dues out of them. This should never come out of the mouth of a union leader. And yet, you know,
Alan,
he said what nobody else wants to say.
I'm going to touch on a couple other things because I want to spend a little time talking about a left agenda moving ahead in 2014 because as we talk from time to time, you know, we don't want to just concentrate on what the problem is, but we want to concentrate on what the solution should be also. And one thing I found very striking, which is very important, it says real unemployment, also reading from this article from Stephen Lindman, it says real unemployment has seized 23%. Long-term unemployment is at record levels. Over 100 million working-age Americans have no jobs. It's 10 million more than when Obama took office. In December, 74,000 new jobs were created. Five times that number left the labor force. They can't find work. That's 370,000 left. They don't even count these people, Alan. So what Obama, really, when you look at Obama's agenda, when you look at this agenda in Washington, it is taking working people further and further into a state of austerity. That's what's happening in this country. And what, just comment on that about the jobs that are lost. When they talk about they're creating jobs, they're losing jobs quicker than they can ever create them. And then we need to move on.
These Wall Street, it's very important that people understand that these Wall Street people, they see the working class in the United States as something that has to be beat down into submission to the point where we will work for the same wage as workers in other countries. And they want to take back all the gains that have been made by working people over the years. This is their objective. They want to push us all down into poverty, and then they can manipulate and maneuver us to do their jobs to create the kind of profits that they think that they're entitled to. This is the problem of the entire world right now. You have all these people at the top, the very wealthy, trying to get wealthier. And it's really, in a way, you know, a friend of mine says, well, we should convince these people that what they're doing is wrong. But the reason we can't convince the Wall Street people, the employers, that what they're doing is wrong by hoarding all this wealth and taking even more from the working people, the reason we can't convince them to do otherwise is because they're just greedy parasites. That's all that they are. They only think of their own selfish interests. They're not thinking of the interests of the nation. There's no way for them to do that because this is the nature of the system. And this is what we got to keep bringing before the American people, that the system creates this situation. It's the system, the capitalist system, that puts profits above everything else. And if we're going to find solutions to our problems, we're going to have to start talking about redistributing this wealth that the very wealthiest people are hoarding. We're going to have to talk about redistributing that wealth by increasing the minimum wage to a real living wage. We're going to have to start talking about redistributing the wealth by creating jobs, like through the Workers' Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the CETA program, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. That money that these wealthy people have been hoarding is going to have to be taken away from them and used to create these kind of programs that will put millions of people to work. If we want real sustainable employment in this country, we've got to talk about massive government programs like a national public health care system, which would give the American people free health care provided through a network of community and neighborhood health care centers all across this country, which would employ 12 to 15 million people. If we talk about, you know, Obama talked about child care and preschool. Well, this is the richest country in the world. What's preventing us from having free child care for all children and free university educations for everyone? You know, there's nothing preventing this except that the people at the very top are hoarding all this wealth that we need to take away from them in order to create these kinds of programs. A child care program in this country, a national public child care program would create 3 to 5 million jobs taking care of the children of this country, something that working people desperately need. And this is another thing that working people can no longer afford. Child care is expensive. It's like when you got two people working, one person is working just to pay for the child care. And this is just totally, it's immoral, it's wrong, and it's a situation that should not exist in the richest country in the world, because we have to look at solving our problems by putting people to work, doing the things that are required to make a better life for everyone. And this is something that the capitalists are not able to comprehend or look at. We have to talk about challenging Wall Street for political and economic power and taking the power out of the hands of Wall Street and putting that power into the hands of the people of this country so that we can develop the country in this way. This is the only solution to our problems.
Alan, I see that we talk about minimum wage all the time. And a lot of the left organizations talk about $15 an hour. And I don't think $15 an hour is enough to take care of the needs of an individual, let alone a family. And just recently I saw the gubernatorial candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party here in California calling for $10 an hour. I mean, why would you be advocating a poverty wage for working people? And why should a left organization not understand the realization that you cannot live on $10 an hour? But, Alan, where's the starting point as far as a living, creating not a guaranteed income, but where's the starting point for a minimum wage? Where should we start?
The starting point is analyzing cost of living. Nobody should be expected to work at any job in this country for less than what they are paid to survive.
Well, Alan, let's face it. If we leave it up to this government today, it'll take them 10 years to analyze the problem. Where do we start? Because I'm thinking we need to start at somewhere like around $22-$25 an hour. I mean, but trying to wait for Congress, wait for this government, working people will be in slavery for the next 50 years, waiting for them to analyze. They analyze, but we know it doesn't take care of our needs.
No, we can't expect them to analyze anything for us, because when they do that, they use phony figures and everything. But what I'm saying is working people have to be able to think this through and analyze for themselves. And it has to start with the cost of living. Unless working people understand what their true cost of living is, they can't fight for the kind of wages and benefits that they're entitled to. And this is where it all starts. There's tremendous pressure being brought to bear in this country by business, by government and politicians, and all these so-called labor leaders, that cost of living not be considered when we talk about living wages. And this is, I think, where it has to start, with a good national conversation about how much it actually costs to live. Because unless we bring cost of living into this conversation, we're not going to be able to say what the minimum wage should actually be. Whether it should be $9 an hour, $10 an hour, $15 an hour, $22 an hour, or $26 an hour. I've been saying all along, using my calculations, using the government's own figures, that the minimum wage, to be a real living wage, should be somewhere between $22 and $26 an hour. Now, about a week or so ago, a state representative here in Minnesota who heads up the Minnesota Select Committee on Living Wage Jobs, he pulled out a PowerPoint presentation before a meeting and a hearing that he was conducting, in which he finally admitted that for a family of four to survive, two people of that family had to be working at jobs paying $14 an hour. So that is either two people working for $14 an hour or one person working for $28 an hour. This is the admission on the part of a Democratic state representative who's heading up this important committee here in Minnesota. Why should two people have to be forced to work at $14 an hour jobs that are poverty wage jobs? Why shouldn't one person in a family be able to work 40 hours a week at a real living wage job that's paying between $22 and $26 or $28 an hour, like he says is required? This is the issue in this country. We've got to start talking about the relationship between wages and cost of living. There is no other place to start the conversation. Anybody that tries to start the conversation by pulling a figure out of the hat and that simply looks like more than what somebody else is calling for, this is the wrong way to be doing things. The right way to do things, the left should convene a conference to determine what is a living wage and what that living wage should be based on. And I believe that we should be saying that it should be based on the actual cost of living factors. We have the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics, who tracks in 8 categories and 200 subcategories, in other words, everything that we could possibly buy and need to live. They've already are paid to compile these facts and figures. These are the figures we should be using. The U.S. Census Bureau uses another set of figures. It's like the United States government is like a crooked and corrupt employer who keeps one set of books for themselves and another set for the government and another set to show the union. And we all know that this is what employers do. Well, the government of the United States is doing the same thing. They call it the United States Census Bureau, which compiles a false set of data based on things that they don't include all the things that are required to, for a real life, a real decent life, and then they
you
set
mean
a minimum wage.
The United States Censored Bureau, right?
You're right.
No,
and
I'm
they're
just
the one. Well, that's what it actually is.
I mean, they're keeping the correct information away from us, Alan.
Exactly. And the correct information is stored, and it's really hard to find. I told somebody, in fact, several people, I talked to a group of people the other day, and I said, you try and find the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracking in their 8 categories and 200 subcategories. I said, you try and find that information without calling them on the Internet. It's just about impossible for a person to do. You'll never find the information. You know, people listening to the show can try it themselves. And if they want to, they can, call me and I'll give them the link to that. But it's almost impossible to do. And they want to keep this information away from the people. I read this book by, what's his name, the guy that used to be, Alan Greenspan. And he mm-hmm. says all throughout his book that he considered it very important to get all this information that was being compiled by the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics to the corporations. What about getting this information to the hands of the people of this country so that we can make intelligent decisions on what we actually need? You know, there's no attempt being made to do that. Just the opposite, in fact. They try and keep this information from the majority of the American people because they don't want us to know how bad off we really are. You know,
Alan,
we have approximately
7 more minutes, and I'm going to sort of hit you with some various subjects that you can just respond maybe around less than a minute. The rising cost of tuition, how do we address this from a left perspective or a left agenda for education? We have $1.1 trillion in student debt. Students are they're strapped for a lifetime, and it's creating bondage for them where they can't live productive lives. Where do we start on the left addressing that?
Well, the left should be calling for a free university education in this country. There's no reason for any students to be in debt the way they are.
About forgiving that debt?
They should. Well, the government should forgive that debt. This is unnecessary. We have a government that thinks nothing about spending trillions of dollars on wars and militarism. It would be nothing for this government to forgive that student debt, and they should. This should be the demand of the left in this country, to forgive the debt and make education from child care through university education should be free. I mean, this is a very moral question, and it's a question that needs to be resolved.
Alan, Social Security, we can see that this Congress and this president, they are going after Social Security. I mean, the cuts are coming down the road. Where does the left, what should be done in regards to protecting many of our seniors that are out there?
Well, the left should be demanding...
And our Social future.
Security. The left should be demanding that Social Security, again, be a real living a real living income for retired people is what should be demanded, based on, again, on cost of living.
For decent standard of living.
Right. And this is what Francis Perkins was expecting to happen fairly soon after they created the Social Security program, which she brought into existence. And this hasn't happened, and it's got to happen, and the sooner it happens, the better, but it's not going to happen until people begin demanding it. Right now, we have hundreds, maybe thousands of workers on the Iron Range who have paid into retirement and pension funds, who have been cheated out of these pension funds by the companies, and the politicians are doing nothing about that. Obama gets on in his speech and talks about how we got to have retirement accounts. These politicians like Obama have done nothing to stop the swindle of the pension funds in this country. The corporations have swindled workers in this country out of billions, probably trillions of dollars in their pension funds by declaring bankruptcy and using all kinds of other schemes to get out from under their obligations, where people have worked and contributed to these pension funds, and now they've been swindled out of them. This has to end.
Alan, the military-industrial complex, we have over 780 military bases throughout the world. We're involved in all of these dirty wars. What should we do? Should we close all the military bases, some of them? What military should we still have? What defense should still exist for this country?
We should close all the foreign military bases, in my opinion. We should stop each and every one of these wars and all the interventions. I think there's like 124 foreign interventions going on at some level using the military at this point across the world. We should stop it all and put that money towards things that people need. It's as simple and as easy as that. And there's no reason why, if we have a government that's of, by, and for the people, this wouldn't be what people would do. All the polls show this is what the people want. They want an end to these wars. They want to stop this stupid militarism, and they want to spend that money on things that people need. This is just plain common sense.
Alan, when I look at the left moving forward, how it seems like the left is so divided. What is the prospects of having some type of unity within the next year or 2 years to be able to address many of these major issues that we're facing as a nation and facing on the left?
Well, I think that the conditions are getting so bad in this country that it's going to start to force a unity. I don't know. It's going to take a while yet, it looks like, because people can't agree on a lot of things. But people are going to have to start convening forums and conferences and begin a discussion, not just among the groups that where they agree with each other, but invite everybody into this conversation, liberals, progressives, and leftists, and let's have some forums across this country where we get all this out in the open and begin to discuss it. This is the way to unity. And without doing that, we're going to remain mired in this thing where there's a left group here, another little left group there, some other group over there, and we're not going to be pushing and pulling together the way we have to in order to take on these Wall Street people. We're not going to be able to take them on ideologically.
I might mention, you are a major force on the left, and we always appreciate what you bring to this program. How can our listeners reach you?
Okay, my telephone number is 218-386-2432, or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my blog, the Podunk blog, and all my contact information is there, email and everything. I should point out, I just got a call from somebody 2 days ago that listened to this program. They listened to a bunch of your programs, and they called me and were interested. So, we are getting to people.
People are listening to you all over the place, Alan. I appreciate it. And we thank you once again for joining the program. We look forward to hearing from you, being with you in 2 weeks. And once again, we'd like to thank our listeners for joining the Socialist Insight, and we'll see you next week. Have a good night. Thanks again, Alan. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Yep. Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zach Brown. I'm from antiimperialism.com, filling in for Nick Brown tonight. Tonight we're supposed to have our guest, Ernesto Ayala, from the Raza Unida program here. But to my understanding, Ernesto is just going to be a few minutes late. So while we have a few minutes time, we're going to take time to talk about a few of the things going on at antiimperialism.com, as well as our affiliate website, the Weekly Bolshevik and Revolutionary Ecology. Not sure how many people are familiar with antiimperialism.com. It's something that Nick started quite a few years ago and something that I have been made a part of as an administrator, as well as a few other of our friends. Recently, Nick popularized an article titled The Bayer CEO, We Don't Make Medicine for Poor Indians. I invite everyone to check this article out, The Great Priest by Nick. It's unfortunate that he couldn't be with us tonight. It's an absolutely fantastic article, and it's by far our most read on the site of all time. It's gotten a great amount of popularity on Reddit, on a bunch of different social media. The hacktivist group, Anonymous, even retweeted it on their Twitter page. So it's gotten a great deal of exposure, and it's definitely worth checking out, as well as all of our other stuff on there. I also invite you to check out our recent publication, The Weapon of Theory. It is essentially a Marxist-Leninist-Maoist reader that was compiled by people from the revolutionary anti-imperialist movement in affiliation with antiimperialism.com. It includes articles by myself, as well as Nick and many others. And it's a great introductory publication to Maoism, if you're not familiar with it. And so, yeah, so we're just really excited to be able to put all this forward. We also have our latest edition of the Seize the Time magazine we've put out. And this one is, it's only getting better. You know, it's always been a work in progress. I mean, the thing with antiimperialism.com and the revolutionary anti-imperialist movement is that, you know, a lot of these things are young projects, you know, just getting off the ground. And so it's great to see all the enthusiasm in the movement and see all these influx of new writers. I mean, we get new writers almost every day. We get people coming in, asking questions, emailing, commenting. You know, it's just great to see so much enthusiasm about revolutionary movements coming from within, you know, one of the richest, most privileged areas in the world, being the United States. So that's really fantastic, and it's just an honor to be here and to be able to talk about all these things. And hopefully when Ernesto gets on, I get to ask him some questions about Raza Unida. So that would be fantastic. While we're waiting, we will take some time to visit some of the recent up-and-coming news that hopefully we can talk about. We've been trying to put a few things out on antiimperialism.com. We have a few regular administrators and editors, so the writing process is quite an arduous one, but, you know, we're trying to stay on top of everything. Hopefully within the next week, we will be publishing more material on our theoretical lines regarding the Vanguard Party, regarding capitalism as a mode of production. And I know Nick and others are working on a lot better stuff coming out with the revolutionaryecology.com website, which is a new project for the affiliate websites. And it's just going to be fantastic when that's all put up. I'm just very, very excited to see all this put up. It's great to see all of it coming together so smoothly, you know, and everyone being able to contribute everywhere possible, and that we're all sort of on the same page. And interestingly enough, I thought I'd talk about this very quickly before Ernesto comes on, and that if you notice today, the Dow Jones composite was dropped. Dow Jones industry dropped about ranging 50 points today last time I checked, and it was very interesting actually, because I and another editor at antiimperialism.com were thinking of writing an article making our prediction for when the next financial crisis would be, trying to, you know, compile statistics, compile data from different sources, and put that through sort of a our own analysis as Marxists, and, you know, to try to precipitate when that crisis would be. But it appears that capitalism may be a little bit ahead of us with this recent stock plummet, so we'll see how that all ends up. But that is quite interesting news. And I thought I would take time to very quickly, while we're still waiting, look at Nick's recent article about the situation in Mexico, entitled In Collusion with Drug Cartels and Illegal Loggers, Mexican State Move Against Auto Defensives in Michoacán. My Spanish pronunciation is probably not that well at all. However, I think it's interesting to point this out, and that something that we do in AnarchyAndPeoplism.com is that we always try to analyze, you know, specific and particular current events, you know, within the context of how imperialism is, it how these are manifestations of the current imperialist capitalist social order. And I think Nick's piece here does a fantastic job of showing this, about how the recent, rebellion of Mexicans against their comforter bourgeois, including some more fascist movement elements in the drug cartels, has been part of a wider class struggle throughout the history of Mexico and with the native Mexican people, natives and Zapatistas, and how all that is interconnected. And it's just a great piece overall. And Nick even includes a video from some of the auto defense militias there. It's just great. It's just great to check out. So that's fantastic. And I just, you know, one thing that we want to kind of throw out here is that, and the reason that we want to bring Ernesto on is to try to show, you know, how revolutionary movements might take a material, concrete existence within, you know, what we would call the first world or the core, or however you want to term it, the more privileged areas of the imperialist chain. You know, how might these revolutionary movements take a material formation? And we think that Raza Unida and other programs that seek to unite historically oppressed and marginalized peoples within the core, within what we term the United States and former colonial possessions, about how these organizations can serve as sort of a center for movement, if you will, rather than the old, more dogmatic socialist point about trying to organize labor unions or the most advanced of labor unions, so on and so forth, but rather how we might be able to organize the most oppressed and the most exploited in any given social condition for the negation of capital-social relations. So that's really the reason why we want to bring Ernesto on, is that, you know, he has incredible insight from his work within Raza Unida, that hopefully that we can use that sort of experience and we can work together to advance the interests of the marginalized and exploited peoples as a whole throughout the world, not only just within the United States.
I think that the fact of the labor unions in this country, they say there's about 7% of the people that are in the unions, and people look at the heads of those unions, they're millionaires. It's like they're not really looking out for the real labor.
Right. And, you know, we always put forward this thesis of the labor aristocracy. But when you think of the actual union heads, I mean, that is beyond labor aristocracy. That is petty bourgeois. I mean, these individuals are making millions and millions of dollars off investments off the surplus labor of the workers that they're claiming to represent, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that that is our major criticism of the broader left, you know, even the radical broader left, the trade unionists. You know, the radical elements of, you know, AFL-CIO and others, and that if you're unwilling to challenge the structural excesses of this labor aristocracy, of this massive excess on behalf of the union heads, on behalf of the petty bourgeois elements within those movements, then you're not standing for the working class. You're standing on behalf of capital.
And don't we have enough of that in our political so-called leaders anyway? I mean,
right, exactly. That's not what we need from labor unions.
No, absolutely not. I don't know if you caught the show right before this, the Socialist Insight. Alan Mackey in Minnesota was talking about some of the I don't know who it was, but one of the labor heads up there, had said that they weren't going to fight for more than a minimum wage of $9. Minnesota is six something, because he said we're not getting any dues from those people. So, you know, I mean, that was plain. He just said it. And, you know, Alan is very much into the working people. And he was appalled. It's like, well, you know, what can you expect then? If this is a labor leader, and he says, well, we're not going to really fight for you gung-ho because we aren't getting dues from you guys. Yeah, that says a lot.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is, it's just one microcosm of a much larger problem within the United States, and it's not something that can be fixed overnight. I mean, it's taken decades of co-option from the middle class elements, the petty bourgeois elements of the laboring classes to get to this position, and it's a protracted process to get out of it. But it is outrageous for these labor unions to essentially liquidate the class struggle. You know, liquidate their entire point is to labor on behalf of the working peoples. And if they're not doing that, then they are not fulfilling their whole social context, you know, their whole role. That's why they were brought forth. And, you know, and that's something that even Jay Sakai talks about in his rather controversial or radical book, Settlers, the Mythology of the White Proletariat. He talks about how labor unions have been almost instrumental in some ways in maintaining this domination of whites over marginalized groups, but also simply in re-entrenching capitalism, you know, with these labor unions that are unwilling to actually challenge capitalism as a mode of production, you know.
Right. And so it's just, there is no use for them then. I mean, we really need unions. We need good unions who will for the people they're supposed to. But as far as what we have, that's not it.
Right.
So what do you, before Ernesto comes on, Zach, what advice do you have to people who have started to become awakened, but, you know, they spend a lot of time watching TV because they're so discouraged and depressed when they come home from working at a job they don't like for not enough money to pay for things that they've been convinced that they need and have no time to use. You know, so how do you get them, even though they're starting to wake up, how do you get them involved?
Right. I mean, that's the million-dollar question for all organizers, I think. And for me, in my own personal experience with that, I think the biggest thing is just trying to find a connection group. You know, find a collective that shares the interest that you have, you know, but that can also motivate you to grow in your understanding, you know, and to give you motivation to make change possible. Because there is this terrible danger of apathy within revolutionaries. I mean, you see this. You see revolutionaries that burn out. You know, people that get involved, and then 20 years later, they're, you know, just another lackey for the Democratic Party. So it's about momentum. You know, it's about keeping the motivation.
But what about those people that are still, I mean, they're still on the couch. I mean, they've started to figure out a few things. But how do you get them involved in the first place then?
As far as getting them involved.
We do a lot of one-on-ones. And because it's always nice when you have somebody say, hey, you know, I finally got it. Thank you. You know, that kind of thing. But we're not doing it for the banks. But, I mean, there are people who just get discouraged right from the get-go because they look around them and they don't really know what to do. So we're not talking about
activists.
We're talking before you become an activist. That's people who want to become activists.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that this is what Mao calls in his On Knowledge. He calls this perceptual knowledge, right? That every individual, to some extent, perceives their oppression. They understand that they are oppressed, that there's something wrong. You know, like when, if you've ever seen The Matrix, Morpheus talks about, you know that there's something wrong, you just don't know what, you know? And part of our job, me and you and many others listening, I'm sure, as part of trying to be a revolutionary, is how can we find a way to access these people? How do we push them in the direction of making social change? How do we make their perceptual knowledge into rational knowledge, into where they don't just know that something's wrong, they know that racism is a problem, that national oppression is the problem, that capitalism is the problem. You know what I'm saying? Imperialism is the problem. How do we make that logical jump? You know, and that's something that I spend time talking about in my piece, Social Investigation and the Science of Revolution. You can find that at antiimperialism.com as well. But it's a great question, Ruthanne. And if I had the answer to it every time, I don't know. I'd be in a much better position, I guess. But, you know.
Yeah, it's rough because you when you see that little flame starting to rise up in someone, you want to nurture it.
Definitely.
You don't want to let him slip back into that couch setting thing.
Right. And that's a real danger. I mean, I know a lot of working class people, and that's the reality of the United States. I mean, granted, the United States is very privileged, but at the same time, the United States has what we call a politically silent majority. You know, a majority of the electorate does not vote. And especially in the working class, yep. A lot of people feel disenfranchised with their political organs, and rightfully so, because these political
definitely.
Organs don't act on their behalf, you know?
No. Well, that's like, I know that people who are socialists, that's what they say, but they're actually working toward Band-Aids instead of changing things. They just think, well, you know, if we just change this little bit, we put the Band-Aid here, it's all going to be better. And instead of recognizing it's got to be rutted out.
I mean, I agree. And that's the kind of thing you see with, you know, and that was the logic. If I don't mind actually naming names of organizations, this is why I initially distanced myself when I became radicalized from the Communist Party USA. Because their whole line is more than what I would call a minimalist line, you know, more than going for the minimum, the lowest common denominator. I mean, they are literally trying to slap Band-Aids on everything, you know, and their latest Band-Aid has been President Obama. But,
I was going to say,
you know,
yeah, they suggested people vote for him.
Right. It's ridiculous. It really is. It's absolutely.
What?
It's unconscionable.
Yes, absolutely. So I don't.
It is unconscionable that a party that once stood for working class militancy and the rightful overthrow of the bourgeoisie by the working class now is telling people to vote for a man who says that free market capitalism is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean,
yeah.
It's disgusting, really. I mean, it upsets me really that the organization would do such a thing. You know, and at the same time, I recognize the need to struggle for working people on things like minimum wage and so on and so forth, you know, to try to advance the lives of working people. But while I keep that in mind, you have to understand that that's only one part of a larger program. You know, that's not the program itself. You know, our program has to be the dictatorship of the proletariat. It has to be the supremacy of working peoples in their society. That has to be our goal, you know?
That's what I was thinking about that recently, Zach, because like you, I mean, I'm all for minimum wage being raised. People are having a terrible time. But it's like that isn't the end all and be all. So it's in its own form. That's just another sort of a Band-Aid to get us from point A to point B. You see while we're actually trying to get way down the line.
Right. And, you know, and the thing is that the minimum wage thing, like you said, it is a point A to point B. And I'm someone who works for a minimum wage myself. And I know that, you know, that doesn't always pay the bills. You know, and that's why we need to struggle for it. Because this is a... are we going to eat or are we not going to eat type question for most working people. And so that's why it's essential that we as socialists, communists, revolutionaries, whatever sort, that we struggle for that. However, I understand that we're not, that's not, I'm not just going to take one bite out of the pie and be happy. You know,
yeah.
We need to take the whole bakery. You know, this needs to be a society run for the benefit of the working people, period. That they need to have political supremacy in every facet. You know,
and all
and that
the means of production.
Right,
we,
exactly.
We need these
exactly.
Big corporations owning all of this. That's bull. The workers need to own it. And you know, then
yeah,
we're not going to worry all that much about profit because we're not trying to compete with somebody else. We're trying to feed and clothe and house all the people.
Absolutely.
And, that's,
and that's...
It can be done.
That's the difference between what Brendan Cooney called, he said in capitalism, farmers grow food to make money. In socialism, farmers grow food to feed people. And,
yes.
And it sounds like a very... you know, subtle difference, but it's a big difference because the whole society should be structured around meeting the actual needs of people before the profits of, you know, whatever small select minority of people you want to say, whether it's the 1%, the bourgeoisie, whatever it is, you know, that is oppression, that is exploitation. That doesn't benefit the vast majority of people who built this country and who built every nation on earth, you know.
Right. And who still are. Something that
Absolutely.
Bothers me a lot, and I find it in the left too, there's so much consumerism. And from people who, you know, claim to be on the side of the, quote, workers of the world and all this, but, you know, the United States has 5% of the world's population, and we're using up, depending on who you talk to, what figures, but between 30, 35, 40% of the natural resources of the whole planet.
Right. Yeah, that's...
Now,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
Excuse my ableism. I shouldn't say crazy. I shouldn't psychologize it, but it is. It's absurd. It is unsustainable at the very least.
Well, and just like our military, I say our because it's the United States. I mean, they're not mine, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, they don't serve. They don't serve the wicked, you know.
No.
They serve to
oppress. Well, they buy, I just recently found out, that a lot of the uniforms and all come from those factories in Asia where the people are, you know, locked in, the big fires, where people were just recently in Cambodia having big demonstrations because they wanted to double their wages, that would take them up to $100-some a month.
Right.
I mean, and so, you know, people here can say what they want, but as long as they're buying things from there, and then the government sets that kind of an example.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a classic example of, you know, if I might make a historical analogy of when, you know, they take the horrible atrocity of where, you know, you had Nazis forcing the Jews, Polish people like myself and other ethnic minorities to build the concentration camps, right? And so now you see that the U.S. military is outsourcing its production not only to people within the third world, but to prisoners within the United States, where private prisons and state public prisons, prisoners are contracted to build munitions for the police and for the military. It's crazy. It's ironic, yet it's reflective of the society we live in, where we are, in many ways, quite literally building the means of our own destruction.
Yes,
you know?
Definitely. Yeah. And, well, my idea of privatized prisons is, or, you know, a whole other thing. I think that's so, you know, they're another corporation. So a corporation's main goal is to make a profit. So
right.
How do you do that? You keep them filled.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, it's...
that they have to have a 90-some% fill. And so that, then they lobby for all these stupid laws that, you know.
Yeah,
and that's,
the prison guards are the biggest lobbyists against marijuana legalization in most states.
Yes. Because that's a big one in this country. What do they say? More than half the people are in for... Well, way more than half are in for nonviolent crimes, but a very high percentage is in for something stupid like weed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, so, you know, the greatest irony of that is that the people, you know, the billionaires and the, you know, damn near trillionaires that, you know, bankrupted the world, especially in the last financial crisis, that caused such suffering, such destruction of working people throughout the world, that those people got bailed out. But, you know, the man, the marginalized, the nationally oppressed man on the street corner trying to feed his family, he's going to prison and for a very
yes.
long time. And
right.
he's making weapons for the people who put him in prison. I mean, it's just...
That is just... It. You know, the way life is right now, if you were to see movie, you would think, what a horrible Z-grade movie that is. And you might ask because it's so weird, but, you know, it's our lives. So it's not
right.
funny. It's just the way it is. But it doesn't happen.
No, it isn't. And, it is. It's very unfortunate, but I think that, you know, the biggest thing is, and I am by no means some sort of quote-unquote revolutionary optimist, as it's been termed, you know, but I'm not a pessimist either. You know, I try to analyze things. I try to see things how they are because, you know, we need to see things how they are. We need to see the chains of oppression. We need to see the functions of this oppressive society to destroy them, you know.
Yep.
And that is the biggest goal here, is that, you know, that if history has shown us one thing, it is that nothing is indestructible. You know, feudalism fell. Slave societies fell. Capitalism will fall.
Yep.
To me, that seems to be historically obvious. And it's, you know, it's our duty, you know, to raise the consciousness and to organize the subjective forces by which we can topple this oppressive system. And it's more than a historical necessity. It's a social necessity. It's a moral necessity. It's an ethical obligation on our behalf as human beings, you know, to end a system where, you know, 40% of the food in the United States can be thrown away.
Yeah.
On average, 10 to 12 million people can die of hunger-related illnesses and causes. It's just, it's
yeah.
unconscionable. You know, in this sort of society, you know, whatever kind of moral consequentialism or deontology you describe to, it can't be considered just. You know, whether you're religious or not, you know, is that the kind of world you want to live in? Because it's not the kind of world I want to live in, you know?
Right. I mean, when I use the phrase spiritually bankrupt, because that's how I look at people who are so consumer-driven, think things make them happy, so they must have them, so they must work hard to get this and that. And I'm not looking at it from a religious viewpoint, but I just think that we're missing something because we've been dumbed down so much. They've tried to keep people, you know, what do they say? They want people to be smart enough to push the buttons, but not smart enough to think.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and this is something that Marx talked about early. And yeah, the concept of alienation. And, you know, I, like many communists, am critical of alienation strictly from a philosophical sense of that, you know, how do we determine alienation? But I would agree. I think it's materially observable that we as humans, throughout the progression of imperialism and capitalism, we are being alienated from our social existence, from not only from the products of our labor, but the way in which we interact with each other through commodities rather than through actual communication, as Marx called the fetishism of commodities. You know, that everything that is in this capitalist society is being transmuted through the exchange of commodities, rather than the actual interaction of us as human beings, you know? And so that sort of alienation creates all sorts of psychological problems, you know? Speaking of that, we're trying to feature an article coming up within the next couple of weeks on antiimperialism.com about the effects of capitalism and capital-social relations on the mental psyche, about it causing depression and physical debilitation in the form of people just feeling physically exhausted, physically deteriorating, and dying much quicker because of it. You know, that these are
yeah.
all real observable things.
Well, that's good, because while we know a lot of these things, or we have some personal experience, It's good to have verifiable, like, research kind of things so you can show people who don't believe it so much.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. Yeah, because, you know, one of the things that we always try to do is that, you know, and this is what I do when I try to write pieces, I don't want to discourage individuals from using their personal experience. You know, because social location and social experience is what all knowledge is founded upon, right? Even research, empirical evidence. However, I try to use empirical evidence, you know, observable things, because I believe in that way we can have a broader grasp for those that maybe don't have those same personal experiences. You know,
exactly.
People we're trying to convince that aren't in the same social location, you know.
Right.
But I definitely agree that using your personal experience,
people,
your own practice is very important.
Well, yeah, your personal experience, I mean, that's what you feel very strongly about. Also, but sometimes you need a little bit more for credibility for different groups of people who they're just starting to wake up, but they want to see something. Yeah, and we know that studies can be manipulated and are all the time by the government and universities that are funded by the government and corporations that kick back to the government. And, you know, so many things be nothing anyway. The more the people are open and tell their own stories and all, I think that's great. You need to, because something about your story may just resonate with somebody else who's going through that or knows somebody who did or whatever. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it's just like me. Yeah.
Yeah, and the quote from Che Guevara, he wrote that, you know, socialism has to be more than just a mundane science. You know, it has to be organic. People have to be involved. They have to exchange and share their experiences, and that's how politics and socialism should be shaped. You know, organically, and I definitely agree. And, you know, it's often said that, you know, numbers are data. What makes a statistic is ideology. You know, when you look at people who want to talk about the great famines of socialism and so on, I mean, those are called genocides because capitalism won in that sense. You know, they don't want to talk about the tens of millions of people who die, you know, every few years from hunger-related illnesses. That has nothing to do with socialism. That's all capitalism. But that's not a genocide, and you don't hear about that in the news because of ideology, you know. So it can be manipulated, definitely.
Sure. I mean, it's all perspective. And then we know that the media, mainstream media, is pretty much a joke anyway, owned by, I've heard six major corporations own, what, maybe 80% or more of the mainstream media, at least in this country.
Yeah. I mean, it's everything serves to reproduce capital in society. I mean, from everything from the television we watch to the books we read to the companies that own what we call news, I mean, it's always going to show the current social order in a good light. You know, that's why people like me and you, Ruthann, and people like Ernesto Ayala and others who are working to try to organize, to try to raise consciousness, that's why this is so important, because it's the counter, I hesitate to say counter hegemony, but it is it's their power and it's our power. You know, they are the oppressor power. We are the oppressed power. You know, and these are competing powers. And that's what makes our role so important, you know, is that we have to be able to show a different side of this social order, a different side of capital social relations, not just the, holy cow, it's so great, we have iPhones and iPods, but the mother who can't feed her kids, you know, or the father that's imprisoned, or the workers working for 25 cents an hour, you know, that's our job.
Exactly. And there again, it's... for a lot of us, it's not that hard to walk our talk because, like you said, I mean, we don't have the money just flowing in, and so we know what we're talking about. his experience. Go ahead.
I mean, this is something we talk about between editors and administrators at Anti-Imperialism, is that it's funny because we're like, you know, we're all about, you know, if you can get money, you know, get it because we can use it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the thing that, you know, definitely we are, or at least we try to be, an organ for oppressed peoples, for working class free peoples, for those who are oppressed sexually, or oppressed by their gender, or, you know, in their gender, or from some sort of oppression, from some point of oppression. We want to be their organ of representation. We want to stand for them against their oppressors. But at the same time, you know, we need material resources to do this, you know.
Definitely.
And what stronger material resource than abstract social power and money, you know? And curiously enough, imagine that, capitalism has made it so we don't make a lot of money. But, I mean, that's something that can change over time.
Yes. No, I believe that. But, well, sure. And so many people who are making the money, I mean, you'll hear about different kinds of movie stars, et cetera, who are, like, on the left bandwagon. They're here and they're for this and this and this. And, oh, they gave buku bucks for some cause. Well, that buku bucks, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to the story in the Bible. I grew up in the church, even though I'm not Christian, and where they were, you know, making fun of some lady, some widow lady who gave her, you know, very small, small, small amount. And Jesus jumped all over these people because he said, well, you know, you give this and this and this, but she gave everything she had.
Right.
And so I don't, I mean, oh, it's fine. Are, you know, killing the law somewhere, because, right, they didn't have to do it. But on the other hand, it is not diminished their luxurious lifestyle that is based on workers making the 25 cents a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and Slavoj Žižek, the Slovenian philosopher and marginally a communist or socialist, I guess you could say, of sorts, he's very critical of Marxism. But anyways, very smart individual. He had a lecture called First His Tragedy, Then His Farce, and he basically talks about this. He specifically mentions the George Soros example, you know, where George Soros is this billionaire who makes, you know, tens of billions of dollars super exploiting individuals in the periphery, and even within the United States, but he gives away part of his money, and, you know, Slavoj calls that he's trying to almost spiritually redeem himself, you know, because he, more than anyone, should know the brutality of capitalism, you know, should know the brutality of what that greed causes. But he tries to redeem himself by, you know, giving a little bit back.
Yeah.
Like you said, I mean, that is, it's not
it's
a good heart for one.
No. It's of no sacrifice to him. Now, I know people who fast one day a week and give them, I mean, these are people that don't have much to begin with, but the money don't spend on food, they give to a cause, like to help somebody else eat, kind of thing.
Right.
Now that, I consider walking your talk.
Right. Definitely.
You know,
and
actually, I mean, they're making a sacrifice, willingly, but they are. I mean, because they could just as easily eat it. But these wealthy, wealthy people, they don't even notice it.
Right. And I think, and I agree, I think that there are, if I may, I think there's a lot of people that call themselves leftists or that are in the broader left, not to try to demean ourselves, but I think there's a lot of people that want to, quote unquote, die for revolution, but not a lot of people that want to live for revolution.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I'm about.
Yes.
You know, we should want to live for revolution. We should want to actually devote our lives to making this social change possible, to making the next great social rupture, not to simply, because dying for revolution is one single act. You're just dying and it's done. Why not make your whole life about that social action rather than just one particular instance of it? So, yeah, I totally agree.
I mean, that's where your heroes come in. I mean,
definitely.
You know, somebody gets killed really walking there, but they're doing something, they're demonstrating, they get killed, or something like that. It's like, okay, but just to
decide, okay, I'm going to go out there and my blood's going to run. And it's like, well, you know, stay around. Stay with the rest of us. Really make your life count.
Right.
But
yeah,
well,
and,
so I
yeah, you can.
I was just going to say that, like you said, you're not trying to knock the other less, but I think sometimes a lot of us do get irritated with some people on the after who say they are, because they don't seem to really take it very far. And we've seen what happens with people in the center. They've all gone to the right, you know, and the people
right,
on the right,
right.
Far right. Obama, who is supposedly, well, you know, Democrat, you think a little bit left maybe, is way over there with the other fascists on the right-hand side.
Right.
You know, so you have a wider division, I think, than we have before.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not crying over that division, honestly. I think that, and this is something I want to spend some time talking about maybe in the future, in a future piece when I get some time, but, you know, this is kind of what we're seeing now with more far-right rhetoric in the United States, especially in the United States, sort of predominating the traditional bourgeois political organs. I think in some ways that's a good thing because while it doesn't mean that the working people will get a lot of immediate gains, what it does mean is that the revolutionary movement will be strengthened as a whole because a lot more people who are in the center or even those
yes.
who are considered themselves middle class, they'll become disenfranchised
yes.
and disassociated from this far right, and they'll look for something else, and that's where we come in. So I think that overall this can help us gain more momentum.
No, I think so. I mean, it's going to work against them in the long run. It's because it's so obvious to people that a few years ago it wouldn't have been that obvious to them because it wasn't so blatant. But the more blatant it becomes, the more obvious, and people start listening to us more. So
right.
I think
we were talking about earlier, I think that you know, we need to spend more time focusing on the masses, focusing on the people, and not so much on the heroes. Because I think that one of the problems is we tend to fall into this trap of thinking that it's heroes that make history. It's the great
yeah.
men of history,
yeah.
but really it's the people that make history. I mean,
people.
You know, Vladimir Lenin was a great leader, but it was the Bolshevik soldiers that won the revolution. It wasn't Mao Zedong. It was, you know, it was all the communists in China that made the revolution. You know, it's,
right.
it's the people every day who are, you know, the masses that are invigorated, that are feeling, that are taking power into their own hands. Those are the people that are making history, not the martyrs, not the heroes. You know, those are good people, don't get me wrong.
Oh, but, no, sure.
That's... In the long run, they're not the ones that make history, you know.
No. And that's something that we have to encourage. The schools don't do it, and some parents don't. But if you have small children or even older children, helping them understand that they're very powerful, you know, because people feel so helpless, and so we don't have self-empowerment. It's not taught.
Right.
And I think
yeah.
that when people, you know, actually realize that they have more power together than any of these governments or organizations. But we just
yeah,
have
definitely.
To show that.
And I think you see this especially in the communities of marginalized peoples, such as Black communities, Latino communities, because a lot of these young children, they grow up in an environment where, in too much agreement, in my opinion, that a lot of, I mean, they didn't choose to be born into a marginalized community, and so much of their life has been dictated by something that's completely out of their control, you know, their social location within society, you know, that their parents are, you know, they don't have jobs, they're in a bad school district, there's drugs, there's violence, there's all sorts of things, and it's that kind of culture which is why you see things like, you know, the petty, the bourgeois nature of rap, where you see marginalized groups of people like young Black boys who actually have a chance to make a lot of money, to feel socially powerful, and they they love that. They yearn for that, and rightfully so, because they've been so historically oppressed. So
yeah,
I definitely agree. I think that, you know, the social structure is very conditioning, you know, and how it shapes them, but people have to understand that, you know, that there is a way to fight it, that there is a way to objectively change your material conditions, to change these social relationships, and that comes through revolution. It comes through dual power, you know?
It does. And so we have to encourage people and let them know it is possible. We have a caller. I don't know if this is Ernesto, an 818. Is this Ernesto? Or
yes.
Okay. There you go. We've got like 12
Ernesto?
Minutes left.
Hey, hello.
Hey, Ernesto. This is Zach. How you doing?
Pretty good, brother. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no, definitely. Yeah, we're a little late, but I'm filling in for Nick tonight. I don't know if he let you know. My name's Zach Brown from AntonPealism.com. We got a few minutes left, so Ernesto, if you don't mind, let me ask you a few questions real quick, and I'll let you do most of the talking here, since this show is principally about you, my man. So my first question for you, Ernesto, is that what is Raza Unida? For a lot of listeners that don't know what the organization is or what it does, can you explain it to us?
Yes, La Raza Unida is our tool as Chicanos, Mexicans, we consider Raza. It could be, you know, any person of indigenous or quote-unquote Latin American descent living here in the Valley of the Beast. It's our tool, you know, to organize, you know, our people, you know, towards, like you're saying, basically towards revolution. It has a long history, you know. It started in the late 60s, early 70s as a third party for Chicanos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but after, let's say, like 10 years, they began, well, they understood, a lot of sectors in it understood, but they understood that, you know, electoral politics will only take you so far, you know, there's, you know, and well,
right.
You know, here some grassroots organizing, they would raise, you know, a couple hundred dollars, you know, the Democrats and Republicans would, you know, spit it out like nothing, you know. So
right.
it was pretty hard. No, but it, you know, it became, you know, a revolutionary, I guess you could say a revolutionary party, Chicano Raza Revolutionary Party in the late 70s, you know, and that's when it basically stated that it is, you know, that they had defined themselves as Chicano revolutionary nationalists and were and are for the national liberation of Aztlan.
Definitely. And as part of Raza Unida, if you could, very briefly, just to look at the United States, who would you consider as your allies currently, just within the organization, you know, looking at all the parties, all the different organizations on the left in the United States, who do you consider your allies, and who are your enemies?
Yeah, well, I mean, other than other Chicano or indigenous organizations, you know, there's, of course, you know, the African Black Power movement and organizations, you know, like the Uhuru Movement, the
mm-hmm.
All African People's Revolutionary Party, you know, and on the left, what is commonly referred to as the left, you know, it's very hard to gauge, you know, which, you know,
right.
which, you know, these left organizations honestly support, you know, the struggles of colonized and oppressed peoples inside of the belly of the beast. You know,
right.
So we've actually found a lot of people that, you know, on paper they say they support it, but in person, you know, their attitudes are the complete opposite.
Right. And part of our politics at AntiPurism.com, you know, we call ourselves openly a Marxist-Leninist and Maoist organization, but part of our politics, and I think what tries to separate us, is that we are very critical of what you call, you know, like these fake leftists, you know, people who claim to be leftists but don't actually want to ally with, you know, struggles of the nationally oppressed people such as, you know, Raza Unida and other Chicano organizations. I mean, what would you have to say, you know, to those people?
Well, well, to those people, I would have to, you know, ask them or to tell them, you know, they should if they're going to say communist, because I consider myself a communist as well, you know, I believe in scientific socialism, you know, I just, you know, I understand that, you know, our route is this specific route of, you know, that we have to unite our people first, the working class of our people, you know,
right.
unite against imperialism and the bourgeoisie, and, you know, and the I wouldn't even call them Chicanos, but brown bourgeoisie. You know, I would tell them, you know, to be a communist, you have to take, you know, your scientifics. You have to take into consideration what are the actual conditions in whichever, you know, country or nation or community that you're in. You know, I think, you know, just about every, you know, these great, you know, men and women that we admire, from Mao to Lenin to, you know, of course, all the other ones, you know, Ho Chi Minh, Nkrumah, all of them, they all, you know, stated that their struggle had to take on a national aspect. It had to, you know, be something that obviously the workers of that country could relate to. And that's exactly what we're doing, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
Just saying blanket statements like, you know, the working class and trying to deny the actual history of struggle, you know, within, you know, what we consider, you know, Aslan or for Africans, you know, in their community, and, you know, is completely chauvinistic and it's offensive and it's counter-revolutionary, as a matter of fact, you know, I believe, because it really damages, you know, whatever revolutionary process could be taking place.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, I entirely agree. And there's been some, you know, some kind of preliminary talk about eventually some sort of perhaps socialist reunification between occupied Aslan and Mexico as it exists today. I mean, what would your thoughts on that be? I mean, that's looking into the future, but just from what you know now.
Well, you know, from the way Mexico is today, I mean, that would be, of course, impossible.
Right.
And, you know, but we feel, at least in La Raza, we feel, you know, if that is something that would be on the plate, you know, the people of Mexico would have to also decide on that, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, work towards that, you know. I'm not sure if any organizations in Mexico really consider that. You know, if they did, that'd be great, but I don't really see that as being one of their priorities. You know, I'm not going to say that we're completely against it, but, you know, we're not completely against it, you know, but it's like, first let's liberate Aslan, let's, you know, make revolution here, and as the people in Mexico do the same over there, I'll probably way more before we do.
Right.
You know, they'll decide whether they want to unite with us or not. You know,
right?
Because I mean, eventually, we do, of course, believe in, you know, in international union of all of our countries.
Definitely,
you know, that's way into the future, of course. But yeah.
And if you could, I mean, I don't know if a lot of our listeners know. I certainly do not. What does La Raza do? What are some programs going on right now? What are some projects going on right now that La Raza is doing that, you know, people might be interested in?
Well, we have, you know, several projects that we've had for a while. We're trying to develop further. One of the longest ones that we've had contemporarily is we have this program we do in the winter, mostly in December. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, whole holiday thing, but it's called we call it Fiesta en el Barrio. What we do with this program is, while all the, you know, all these other mainstream groups and agencies are, you know, like giving away toys and just doing the whole material thing, you know, we try to, you know, we raise funds on our own with the help of other organizations as well, you know, and we, you know, buy educational materials, you know, some toys here and there, you know, small things like that, but, you know, and but we also include, you know, some political education. We have, you know, parents, community members coming over, and, you know, we give presentations on what is La Raza Unida, you know, culture, you know, things of that nature. We want to develop that further, you know, to where it could be something that doesn't only happen in the winter season. And eventually, of course, you know, from that, spread into actual community programs where, you know, we could have, you know, food co-ops, we could have, you know, clinics, we could have, you know, spaces for the youth after school to, you know, go and spend time there, you know, if they need help with education, which is also part of what we're trying to get is a low-power FM radio station.
Uh-huh.
We applied for it, you know, and so we're waiting on it. Hopefully we're going to get it in the summer. Through that, we're going to also, you know, use it to reach out to the community and start, you know, moving on these programs even further, you know, based on, you know, whatever, you know, like a program on health, you know, program on education, and from that develop actual programs in the community. We also are involved in a couple of commemorations, you know, the Cesar Chavez commemoration, of course, which is always a struggle because we have to deal with a lot of the mainstream conformist bourgeois Hispanic organizations.
Right.
You know, and they've tried to get rid of us from that, but you know they can't, especially here in the San Fernando Valley. You know, we just have a lot of history here.
You know, it's strong,
yeah.
You know. Definitely.
Yeah.
I don't want to cut you off, Ernesto, but they're telling me I got 2 minutes left with you. It's unfortunate I only have a few minutes with you, but I really appreciate you coming on and talking all this. It really means a lot, Ernesto.
Of course.
Mr. Ayala, wait, real quick for our listeners, how might listeners who are interested in La Raza and the programs or want to donate or get in contact with you, how might they do that?
You can visit our website. It's larazaunidaparty.org.
Okay.
We're also on Facebook. Just look up La Raza Unida. You'll find the contact information there. You know, if anyone listening right now is interested, they could call me directly. If I could get my phone number, would you do that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. It's area 818-810-8724. Again, that's 818-810-8724. And you know, we're growing a lot of interest. You know, going along, I guess, with a growth in our population, you know, the masses of working raza, you know, that not only here, what we've always called the flat, but, you know, even going further beyond, you know. But, you know, yeah, a lot of people understand that there's a need to organize.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on, Ernesto. We all support your struggle and the struggle of La Raza and all the great work you're doing in the Chicano community. We wish you the greatest luck and the greatest revolutionary spirit moving forward. Thanks again for coming on, my man.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah.
Good night. Thank you both.
Good night.
Yeah, thank you for having us on, Ruthann.